What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Marius, Tack Theratrix.
I am Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison? Swingles and foreign lockdown.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff to German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Rumble, band.video, Vigilante TV, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks a million. We appreciate your amazing and continued support. If you haven't rated the show yet, I would appreciate it if you do it. Take 5 seconds to go down there. Give us 5 stars if you think we've earned it. If you want to connect with me, macroaggressions.io is the website. It's the best place to do that. You can find information about Activist Post, Natural Blaze, the books, the podcasts, all that good stuff is all over there. And we're so appreciative of our sponsors. We got to get good ones. It's got to all make sense, right? Chemical Free Body has been with me since the very beginning of this show. Tim James, the owner of the company, has been on here more than anybody else. He saved his life by changing his diet. He figured it out. He was very unhealthy, but he fixed it. He recognized there was a problem. He got a hold of it, taught himself how to save himself by changing the food that he eats, and he is just going to spend the rest of his life trying to help other people because it made such a huge impact on him. It literally saved his life by changing his diet. So if you're feeling unwell, you can fix this. There's fixable options here. Go to chemicalfreebody.com/macro. Take a look. See what you think. His Green 85 drink is fantastic. You pair that. You do the detox bundle. It's a 90-day program. You'll be in real good shape after that. I mean, anybody who says supplements don't work or you're just filling your, you know, you're just spending money on it's, you're pissing it down the drain. Maybe. And I actually would say probably with most of them. I don't have much respect for the supplement industry, but this one's different. Chemical Free Body's fantastic. You can take that to the bank, man. I've been taking their products every day for 5 years. I can speak from experience. So go to chemicalfreebody.com/macro. Take a look around. The Water Hero, the new product that they have, the Water Hero, is something you need to examine. If you have like a Brita pitcher or a clearly filtered pitcher in your cat, you know, that you're in your house, toss it, get Tim James's Water Hero. It structures the water. It's totally different. It's unlike anything you've ever seen. So go to chemicalfreebody.com/macro and do some shopping. See what you think. Also to our newest sponsors at Augustin Farms, storable food. You want storable food? I got storable food for you, baby. We got buckets over there. If you want to grab a couple buckets and go, they've got that. But if you want specifics, if you want items, like if you want freeze-dried bag of strawberries, where are you going to find that? Not too many places. This place is, they've got it all. They've got storable meats and proteins, fruits, vegetables, eggs, dairy, butter, powder, all kinds of stuff. Like stuff I didn't even know existed. They've got it. And you should take a look. You can go to augustinfarms.com. A-U-G-A-S-O-N MacroFarms.com. Links down in the description. Promo code's macro. They'll save you 10% off your first order. So load up on that first order. Get whatever you can get. But take a look. Emergency kits, camping supplies, recipes for all this stuff. And they even have a fantastic warehouse sales item section too. So if you're looking for something that's currently out of stock or they have, you know, take a look. Go to AugustinFarms.com. Promo code macro. All right. All right, let's get down to business. Ladies and gentlemen, joining us from Unlimited Hangout, it's really good to see John Klesyk back, to the show the first time, but seeing him again after Nashville. Good to see you, John. How are you, man?
Doing okay, Charlie. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on, man. It's good to see you in Nashville. You know, we get to these live events every now and then, reconnect, feel, you know, like you're not alone in this. I didn't expect to see you at Nashville. I didn't know you were coming. Then boom, there you are. How was your experience for Third Eye Carnival back in April?
It was a good time. Yeah. I had popped in on Steve Poikkanen's, one of his shows, and he just was like, hey, why don't you come by? So I did that. And then Pasta Jardula, we went to a conference few years prior, and kind of hung out, and he hit me up and was like, hey, you know, why don't you split the Airbnb with me? So I helped him kind of lug food around and kind of help him cook a little bit. I got to pick up Kurt Metzger from Zany's and drive him to surprise everybody for the birthday party. So that was kind of fun. I got to have an hour alone with Kurt in the car both ways. That was his character.
Yeah. That was great. That was great. When I was sitting up there on stage, and I can see the audience, and I can see out the back door, and I can see you guys walking towards, and I'm going, who is that? Who is that? That's John, but does he have a Bigfoot with him? Like, who is that gigantic guy? It's Kurt Metzger. Kurt Metzger's a huge dude. Like, I was like, I could see from a while, and then you guys got closer. I was like, I think that's Kurt Metzger. That would be really funny if it actually was him. And then you guys walk in, and you guys walk up on stage, and there you go.
Yeah, it was fun time. Yeah, and then we drove back, and basically a tornado, or it was like right behind us the whole time, because the barn, you know, the podcast ended as, you know, it's looking close to tornado style weather. Yeah. So Kurt's like, let's get out of here. And like, we're driving. I mean, we were safe, but he wasn't exactly comfortable. I kind of felt bad for him because he didn't even know he was going to be leaving. He could have just stayed at Zany's and stuff, but it was a good time. It was a good time.
He was a good sport about all that. Sam Tripoli and Leonardo Joni both did stand up in the middle of a tornado in a barn, which was great. It was pouring rain. Wind was blowing all over. And Sam's like, man, I'm losing. I've never been heckled by the weather before, you know?
Yeah, I was totally overdressed for that. I was like on brand, and I ruined a nice pair of shoes my wife bought me. I told Pasta, I was like, these weren't the right shoes to wear. He goes, not at all. I'm like, what's wrong with you? Why don't you? Like, I don't know. I didn't think about it, you know?
Yeah. That's funny. Well, it was good to see you there, man. And I think that I encourage people to get out to these live events if they can, if it comes to your area, or maybe you have the financial resources to get on an airplane and go someplace and do it. Just trade in some of these soon to be worthless Federal Reserve notes for experiences. You know what I mean? Like anything else than what they're doing right now.
Yeah, anything other than screen time, right? It's good for right. It's good for the soul to get some physical information, some human in 3D space interaction, not 3D yeah. metaverse space though.
Exactly. Well, I've been reading your work for a while, but maybe my audience hasn't. Can we just fill them in on who you are and what your background is and how you wound up working with Whitney and the crew over at Unlimited Hangout, or at least submitting articles for them? Like, what's your background?
So I'm a public educator by trade. I teach college rhetoric and research argumentation. I've been doing that for, I guess it's getting close to 15 years now. And, you know, this was before Trump, maybe a year or two before Trump came to rise the first time around. So this is probably 2015-ish, maybe closer to 2016. And where I was working in Illinois, we had a governor at the time. His name was Bruce Rauner. Connery's Republican. And he was basically stalling on the budget. And when that happens, public institutions, they don't get their money. So they get shut down. And I'm looking around and I feel like this is a ploy to push public institutions into private receivership. And lo and behold, that is, by the end of the whole debacle, they did get a voucher bill pushed in. One of my departments had gotten shut down. As a result, so I wrote an article that sort of laid out what Charlotte Thompson Iserbeat had predicted about the school choice movement, which is basically public-private partnerships. Nowadays, a good term might be like stakeholder capitalism for schools.
Right.
And I looked around it. I knew that Rauner was invested in charter schools. There's a Rauner College Prep in the Noble Network of Charter Schools in Chicago. I knew that he was buddy-buddy with Arne Duncan, who was actually the Secretary of Education under Obama. If you looked at his State of the State addresses, he kept talking about career pathways and cradle to career and all these types of buzzwords that Charlotte Iserbeat had warned about. So I wrote that piece, and Charlotte got a hold of it. And was like, hey, great job. Keep up the good work. And that article became a series of articles, which became the first chapters of my book. And Charlotte helped me get in contact with Chris Milligan. Ah, thank you very much, sir. It's over there. Riverside is small, so thank you very much for that.
Yeah, School World Order, by the way, is available. You can get it from Trine Days. Is it on Amazon too? I'm assuming
it's on Amazon as well. Like yeah. Always, if you can, from the publisher is better. But I do get a sense of the numbers when you go to Amazon. That's the only real time metrics I can get, other than bothering Chris constantly, which he's got lots to do.
Too much.
yeah, and one of the reasons why Charlotte was able to put me in contact with him. So for a little background on Charlotte, she wrote The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, but she also wrote two other books, Soviets in the Classroom and Back to Basics. And she worked in the Department of Education under Ronald Reagan, and she blew the whistle on something called Project BEST. That's Basic Education Skills Through Technology. It was this program to set up public-private partnerships between the Department of Education, local education institutions, big tech companies to implement computerized operant conditioning algorithms in the classroom to prepare students for basically workforce training and career pathways. But she was also, her grandfather and her father were members of the Order of Skull and Bones. And so she is actually the person who leaked the black books that have all the names of the Bonesmen in it. She's the one that leaked that to Anthony Sutton. Anthony Sutton wrote, you might be able to see it back there, that yellow book. It's the introduction, America's Secret Establishment, Introduction to the Order of Skull and Bones. That's a reprint that was printed by my publisher, Chris Milligan, who basically rescued Sutton's his seminal work on Bones, on the Bones cult, and had it republished. So she was, knew Chris because of that, and so they sort of put us in touch. And from there, the book kind of took off, and the book got published in October of 2019. So it's just a few months before, the great lockdowns. And when that happened, everything really accelerated. And, they were forcing everybody to use all this ed tech because everybody's forced to be online. And at some point, somebody on Twitter, Pete Lincoln on Twitter, just sent it to a tweet with me in it. And I think Whitney in it as well, and suggested Whitney should we should collaborate or something. I said, that'd be awesome. And she said, send me a DM. So that became the first piece. And I've written quite a few pieces, and I've been writing for her 2021. And so that's kind of everything up to the present moment.
Well, it's a good fit. And it's interesting because, obviously Whitney's emphasis has been on government as organized crime, I'd say, is a sort of in general. But really, the technology side of it has been a real thread that she's been pulling on for several years. And you might think that technology and education don't have a ton of overlap, or maybe some, at the way everything has a little bit of overlap as things are getting digital these days. But in fact, But when you understand like the origins of compulsory schooling and who was behind it and how it was really pretty nefarious, and that they're trying to train you for a world of going into the factories, right? Where you want to work at I don't know, at a Rockefeller or Carnegie connected factory, you're going to sit in these straight line road chairs in school, and then the bell goes off to tell you that the class is over, that the day is over, and then you rotate out, and, you know, simulating what it's going to be like working in a factory. And so you understand, like, schooling is pretty, you know, like, it's normalized for us in America. You wake up, you know, you're a kid, you go to school, that's how it is. You never really ask too many questions about why there's school. You feel like, well, we all need to be educated. Well, who's behind it, right? And once you start digging into it, you have a lot of questions about schooling. And now the blending of schooling with technology, this combination, you know, I mean, I thought Common Core was going to be the death of compulsory schooling, and maybe it's a stain on it for sure. But as we move into this new era where the schooling goes online, maybe even the teachers go online, maybe the teachers in front of your class, you know, listen, I mean, we can't have these teachers. They don't speak 20 languages in New York City. We have immigrants from 20 different countries in this kindergarten class. They all have to speak all the different languages. We have to replace your favorite teacher, Mrs. Johnson, with, you know, RoboCop, who's come in here and now, and it speaks 20 languages, and it'll talk to the kid from, you know, Senegal in the corner who nobody talks to, because, you know, and so you go, oh God, where is this going? Like, I'm okay with the evolution of things, you know, like everything's going to, you know, textbooks maybe turn into tablets, and I go, all right, well, I get it. It's not the worst thing, but I could live with it. But what do you see? Because you're obviously seeing, you're extrapolating out a generation into this. And I mean, I have a level of fear about this, but maybe it's not the quite level of fear that I need. Where do you see this sort of playing out over the next, I don't know, generation for these kids?
Well, if you need a healthier dose of fear, you've come to the right place, sir, because according to Chris Milligan and everybody else, my book is very scary. That's what Chris said. Yeah, it's very scary. It's very scary. And actually, it didn't end with the way it ends now. It now ends, you know, ends with solutions. I just ended with, got to the end of the dystopia and painted the whole picture. And Chris basically said something to the effect of, like, you can't destroy people's hope in the future and just end the book. He's like, you got to give them some kind of, you know, solution. So the last chapter, I kind of, you know, I was learning it as I was writing. But, you know, talking about looking way down where the rabbit hole ends. One of the other things that was happening during that story I told you about Rauner basically destroying public institutions was I was also tutoring for a company at the time. Now, I used to not say the name of the company because they had me on a non-compete clause. And I'm just very careful about, you know, I don't need to be, I stick my neck out enough with my articles, right? I don't need to give anybody any extra reasons to bother me at work or anywhere else. But it was Pearson. So Pearson was this, you know, it's one of the biggest textbook companies. It's a very old company. It's out of England or UK now, I guess. But now, as you know, right, everything's digital, so they've shifted the textbooks in general are digital, but they also have lots of other applications, ed tech applications. And so they had a sub company called Smart Thinking with one T, by the way, isn't that cute? I always like to tell this just so people get a sense of how this should give you a sense of how much these companies actually care about the profession of teaching and learning, right? They, with a master's degree, they were paying me $11 an hour. Now, if I would have went and got five more years of school, I could have got a whole 12 years, $12 an hour if I got that PhD. But what I learned was that while I was doing that tutoring, one day, this is around the same time, they tell us that IBM's Watson is going to co-pilot with us. Now, for those who don't know, IBM's Watson was like the premier AI platform before generative AI took off. A little side note, Watson, the name of it, that's named after Thomas J. Watson. He was the CEO of IBM that did business with Hitler to process use the punch card system to process all the eugenics and the data in the concentration camps, etc. But, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm looking at it and I go, well, every day I go to work, then this I'm teaching this thing to replace me. You know, and I start to think down the pipe, and you start to go, well, hold on. I mean, like, if one day, let's say these bots are better than teachers and they replace all the teachers, why do you need the students? Like, if you're going to teach the student, certainly anything, any sort of cognitive ability or skill that you're going to try to transfer to the student, the bot already possesses it. The bot can be copied and plugged into any. So doesn't that make the student obsolete as well? Right.
Oh,
and
yeah,
so
you're replacing two at once. This is great.
What, say it again. I didn't hear you. What's that? Say it again.
I said you're replacing two people at once. You're replacing the teacher and you're replacing the student. Like, what's the point of even teaching, right? If you're going to get the teacher's going to be replaced by a robot, and then the people, the kids that he's teaching, well, you guys are going to probably get replaced by robots too. So why don't I have the robot teach the robots and just cut out the middleman, right?
Right. And you know, you're looking at it, you know, I'm sitting here going like, well, if me as an adjunct professor, for those who don't know, an adjunct means in community college and universities as well, they're run like companies. So you have like, you know, at a company, you have a couple managers, right? And then you'll have a bunch of staff, you know, that basically do all the work. In a college, the managers, you'd have like, you know, it could be administrators, that'd be more higher up than like basic level managers. The managers are like the tenure track people, but the bulk of the teaching is done by what they call adjuncts. And adjuncts don't, you're not tenure track, which means you're not locked in. You don't get benefits. You don't get an office. You get hired per course, per semester, right? And so, as an adjunct, if I can look at, if I can think that far down the pipe, well, these engineers and the people running the companies that have their, you know, scenario planning and their 10-year plans for growth and profit, they have to know this as well, right? So then you have to wonder, like, well, then is that the point? Like, right? It's not an accident. They must be doing this intentionally, right? And so it's like, you know, and then you start to think that, well, that means that the data mining that all these bots that they're programmed to do, you know, that's embedded in any sort of an AI, that is not a secondary feature. That's the primary feature, right? Like whatever the student might be learning by using the bot, the bot's learning more and it's learning faster. And as it learns faster, it learns permanently and it extrapolates out. So at some point, you're essentially replacing human consciousness with AI consciousness. So then where the book ends up is basically two things, social credit and transhumanism. Because as someone like Elon Musk says, well, if the bot can basically do everything you can do cognitively and perhaps even more, well, you're going to have to interface with it to even be relevant anymore. And that's where you get your Neuralink or your whatever type of brain computer interfaces they have when it gets, commercial ready. And, you know, and so that's, you know, just me sitting in front of the IBM Watson. That's kind of what laid out sort of my vision of this ed technocracy in the future that's way closer than I ever wanted it to be.
Yeah, and you mentioned that they're reframing this, the terminology around this, that public-private partnerships and things like that, stakeholder capitalism. We're hearing these terms a lot by the globalist weirdos. And and it's a code word, right? It means something else. Stakeholder capitalism. You're like, oh, I'm going to be a stakeholder. It's like, not really, but somebody will, but it won't be you. So, what is the goal? I suppose for these kids. I mean, it feels like, are they just data mining the kids? Is that sort of the goal of this? Is like, let's see what sort of data these kids generate and let's hoover all of that information in and let's try to make some sense out of it and sell it to somebody? Or like, what's the end goal for them with this?
Yeah, that's the primary function of the entire system is the data mining. And the data has two primary uses. One is to build the artificial intelligence. So the book goes through a progression of, well, and the other one is to use the data for social credit before I digress and perhaps can't get back to where I wanted to go. Okay. The book goes through a progression of technologies and we're getting close to the end of the book. I mean, like I wrote it and like seeing like, I thought so. If you go back and look at Amazon, they might have updated it. But when it first came out, the book said something like 92 pages. It's 500. 100 pages is citations. That's because a lot of the stuff that I told you I was kind of surmising based on tutoring, I'm like, I'm thinking that this is more spec. Most of that stuff is going to be in the prototypical phase, if not theoretical phase. Lo and behold, they've had prototypes of this stuff. I mean, look. Brain-computer interface, the first neural implant is in the 60s. Jose Manuel Rodriguez Delgado. I mean, that's just one example of like how old a lot of the biofeedback wearables. Like, so I traced a progression of what's called cognitive behavioral adaptive learning courseware. Okay, this is basically B.F. Skinner's, his teaching machine in digital form. So it's going to operate your thinking and performance algorithms. Then there's a series of wearables that can data mine the student's brain waves, their heart rates. They have galvanic skin response monitors. You can also infer emotions from facial recognition. And that's going to data mine their emotional algorithms, their feeling algorithms. You aggregate all that. What they do is they anonymize it. So you have PII and UII. So PII is personally identifiable information. Then you have UII is user interaction information. So basically the UII is all of those different types of algorithms. They just try to, they remove the individual. They take those algorithms, they aggregate them, run them through machine learning, and then crunch them into a large language model with neural networks, etc. And now you have, right, a bot that can interact with human speech and human text, but can also keep track of, right, your cognitive responses, your behavioral responses, and your emotional responses. So, in other words, these LLMs, they're already doing that. And we'll touch on a company that's already replacing some of my tutoring hours at one of the schools where I work. So a lot of that data has gone into to develop these large language models, which those two are going to continue that process. But the other is for the social credit algorithms. And so basically you're going to be data mining, and this is going to be aggregated with other data. So your healthcare data, your workforce data. What I had come to see as I sort of, because I'm looking at it going like, especially with the biofeedback wearables, a lot of them were pitched for what they call assistive technologies. Well, that's for disabilities. Well, if you've ever taught a class, you put in the syllabus on day one. If you have a disability, you can go and talk to the disability. You can't legally be like, who has a disability? Right, it's a medical information. You cannot be requesting that, right? So I'm going like, well, if this is for people with disabilities, and it's like that has to be in a separate, like that falls under a separate purview, like HIPAA versus FERPA. HIPAA would be health laws, FERPA would be privacy laws and education. But you know, so I'm like, well, how are they going to mash all this together? When I stumbled on videos of, I think it was the Journeyman TV documentary on the Chinese social credit system, I was like, oh, that's what it looks like when it all comes together. That's what, you know, and what I'm seeing in this education realm, the data mining of the education is going to go into this central database, and healthcare is going to come from here, and workforce is going to, and criminal justice, and the education is just one aspect of this biopsychosocial profile that they're going to be building on everybody for social credit analytics. And in my most recent piece, what I'm seeing now is not only just social credit for tracking and tracing, keeping supply chains moving smoothly, but like I see that they're going to be basically, they want to securitize human beings. So basically, I had Mark Goodwin help me make sure I was understanding some of this financial jargon accurately. And so, you know, I was asked, so what exactly, you know, this is one of the debates about this stable coin. Should it be a commodity? Should it be a security? So he says, well, what's the difference? Mm-hmm. Well, security says is basically the Howey test. It's like Howey Farms or Howey Orchards or something. So instead of selling land, they were selling people basically the profits you would make on the fruit that was going to grow there, right? Like you could buy, so it's an expectation of future profits not built into the asset itself, right? Because the land could appreciate in value, but that's not, the security is the part of this other thing that this added value. So what they're going to do then is basically with all these analytics, take a look at a student and go, if student A goes through career pathway B and fulfills all these learning and workforce outcomes, they will produce X amount of dollars in the economy, and it will also save us X amount of dollars in terms of criminal justice and mental health because, right, delinquents statistically have shown to fall into the cracks, and then we have to pay money to either incarcerate them or put them through these mental health programs. So, right, they're going to quantify all of that, put it into a bond, and then have companies, social impact investment companies, foundations, et cetera, basically sponsor, what I would say basically purchase a human being like a feudal lord, give you tokens to go on this, specifically for this particular career pathway, for this particular ed tech device, et cetera. And if the student achieves the outcomes, they get more tokens, they keep going. The company also doesn't just get subsidized, but in impact investing, especially in what's called pay for success, and that's out of the Every Student Succeeds Act, they can make a profit. So if the students exceed the outcomes, they can actually get more money from the government. So basically, they created this, I think, the social impact investment, the human capital bonds, the AI ed tech. It's all part of one new financial system because you need the AI to get the data. You need the data to get the impact investment, but the impact investment company also needs the data to get the money from the government, right? And so that's kind of how I see what is the real purpose of all your tech. It's the data mining, all that information, all those metrics for those two purposes.
Might be the grossest outcome I've ever thought of. That they're monetizing, securitizing people, like horse racing, betting on them, investing on them. Well, like, so let me see if this is, let me work this out. You're a kid, let's say you score well on the SATs, right? You get on somebody's radar, all of a sudden, ding, 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 someone starts watching you. They realize pretty early on, based on the calculations, you're probably not going to be in trouble with the law. You're not going to get fall into drugs. You're probably going to have a decent career. You're on the right trajectory. So could they invest in you, so to speak, or what do they do? Do they take a 10,000 other people that are also scored like them and put them into a bond, and then securitize that and sell that on Wall Street and have people sort of like have tiered, you know, like AAA rated people who theoretically will go out and have a 50-year lifespan of generating revenue, money, taxes, whatever, spending, the things that they do. And you have AAA rated, and then I would imagine you have triple B rated, which is like, we took 10,000 people from the hood that aren't going to do much of anything, and you can bet on this if you want, but you're odd, you know, whatever, it's calculated. Is that kind of where we're going, like human livestock being securitized by Wall Street?
Yeah, and so, you know, the rankings of the different, you know, individuals and their associated bonds, that'll, you know, just that'll be the difference in terms of risk. It's like, oh, this kid's doing pretty good. It's safe money. I know I can make my money back on this one. It's like, oh, this one, you might not make your money back, but there's going to be other incentives to do that because this is where ESG stuff comes in. So it's like, you know, the odds that you're going to get your money back for, right, the children that don't score as high is not. But don't worry, we're going to supplement that with ESG because of the fact that you service those people. Look, I'll tell you, this company that is getting, it took many of my hours already. Okay, it's called Upswing, and it's got it's not just, okay, so it's got a bot, it's an AI tutor called Anna. I think that's short for analytics, because one of the selling points is that they got the metrics all over the website, like, oh, our students improve these outcomes by this percent, and, you know, in groups they do, and institution wide, and they have individualized metrics, they have group metrics, you know, race, gender, class, age, zip code, and then they have across the institution. And they even, you know, the administrators sent us an email saying, like, it's going to be great because not only are the students going to have the data, but we're going to have it too. Okay.
Right.
And so Anna can do tutoring, but Anna also does mental health. So it starts with this little promo video, and it's text-based bot. And it starts by, like, just helping the student organize their daily stuff. you know, have an itinerary, et cetera. And then the next part is it asks it to help it with some tutoring. Okay. And then the next part is it's like, I'm having a hard time. You know, I had a family member, something. So now it's into the mental health thing. Okay. And by the end of this, this promotional video, the bot, the student is emotionally bonding with the bot. It says something like, oh, yeah, you care about me so much, and gives a heart emoji, which is all. Go ahead. You want to jump? You want to say something?
Oh, no. That's real bad.
I saw a documentary. My wife watched a documentary the other day. Apparently, people are dating their avatars, these bots. Like, and I'm watching it thinking, like, well, those must be programmed. That's what they do. Their emotional, you know, companion bots. Apparently, that level of emotion, that impetus to emotionally bond with the user, apparently is built into even stuff that has nothing to do with that, like a tutoring bot. You know, so while it's going to connect them to mental health services, like, I'm pretty sure if you're emotionally bonding with a bot that's not a human being, it's going to cause mental problems. I'm pretty sure. Like, I know we don't have the data on this, but I'm pretty sure that's not going to transfer appropriately into, like, normal human interaction. Mm-hmm. So, but where I was going with that to your what we were talking about was, so I look up the company. It's invest, like, one of the companies that funds it is Social Finance. Well, I wrote about Social Finance in my, not the most recent piece I did on Unlimited Hangout, but the Trump Ed 2025, the first piece I did on School of Choice this year in March. And it's partnered with the Koch Foundation, which is, and it was some kind of a pay for success impact investing thing. I also wrote about social finance, or I discussed it, did a report on it, video report on my YouTube channel, showing that it's partners with something called Future Learn. And Future Learn is this, online learning platform that's connected to something called the Open University out of the UK, and that was connected to UNESCO Study 11. UNESCO Study 11 was this global, basically the global version of Project BEST, or another way to say that is Project BEST was America's domestic version of UNESCO Study 11. So this all goes, all of it goes back to Charlotte's that study that she blew the whistle on. So it's, so I know, you know, I know that A, it's taking all these data, all this analytics. I know that most of the people that invest in it are impact finance companies. It wasn't just social finance. That's the one that stood out to me that I was most familiar with. It's a bunch of, and a bunch of venture capital. Now, here's the other kicker. So this particular school is in a predominantly black neighborhood. So it's going to serve predominantly black students. And the company, Upswing, and some of the ones that are invested in it are predominantly black. So that's, ups the ESG, you get more money back from that. So when the school goes, hey, look, we're servicing poor students, we're servicing black students, but look, we're also helping a black-owned company to do it. So that's more social credit points because marginalized communities, et cetera. And so that's how they'll sort of, right, like you're saying, like, well, who's going to want to invest in the people with the lowest scores? That's the incentive, because they're going to, it's going to be supplemented by, you know, government, et cetera.
Well, luckily, ESG is going away now that Larry Fink is the head of the World Economic Forum. Oh, wait, never mind. It's probably going to be here to stay in some form or fashion. What about this other alarming component to this transformation, which is not just the data mining of the students, but now there's digital wallets for them as well, right? We're connecting them in to a world where they're going to be in some ways compensated for their participation. Can you elaborate on where this is going with regard to, I understand that, like, the world is turning digital and there's benefits to educating people, educating kids about where technology is going, and like, maybe you have a wallet in your pocket, you know, but maybe you need a digital wallet in the future. And I could be, you know, there's part of me that could say, like, yeah, you gotta, you know, explain to these young kids, they already know a lot of stuff technologically, like, let's, you know, let's talk to them about digital wallets. But when it's these companies, and then I'd feel much differently about it. It feels like it's part of something else. What are they planning with these wallets for students?
Well, this is as I sort of laid out how the data mining and the ed tech is just part of this aggregate system that connects to mental health data and criminal justice data, et cetera. The digital wallet revolution in the education industry is part and parcel to a larger financial overhaul in both the entire American financial system and the global financial system in terms of the rise of stable coins and programmable crypto money. So how do the digital wallets fit into education? So this is where the school choice stuff comes in. So for people that aren't familiar, school choice basically is a euphemism, nice little double. It's choice, like in the sense that you get, you know, Burger King, McDonald's. Like I drink energy drinks probably more than I should. And I was in the gas station the other day getting one of these, and the guy was a nice guy, worked for Monster. And he was telling me, he was like, yeah, Monster owns like all of these. I'm like, really? It's like, I was like, so, you know, and I never knew that. You're going, and so it's like, you know, I have the illusion that whatever I buy, it's coming from the same company. So it's kind of that, you know, it's going to come from GovCorp. That's the idea of school choice.
Yeah.
But there's two large baskets. There's the charter school movement, and then there's these different financial mechanisms. The charter schooling movement's pretty much locked in. It's more or less ubiquitous. It's basically charter schools are private companies that get subsidized by public tax dollars. These other funding mechanisms, we might call them all, we might put them all under the umbrella of voucher. Maybe we'll call vouchers, and then the other two, sometimes people call them neo-vouchers. As a heuristic, for the sake of expediency, I'll just probably refer to them all as vouchers, but some are referred to as education savings accounts, and some are referred to as scholarships. Now, vouchers have been attempted and got shot down in the Supreme Court, so I think that's why they came up with the other names, which there are some nuances in how the money is distributed. So, like, vouchers were typically just for tuition, but education savings accounts it's a basket of money that you can use to purchase. Maybe it's tuition, maybe it's private tutoring, maybe it's a range of ed tech devices, maybe it's therapies, etc. But I think they use education savings account because we actually have those IRS. Like there's ESAs, I forget the IRS code, but that's where you can put money into it and you can get a write off. Not the same thing. This is government money that goes to you, taken from other people, given to you, right? And then the scholarships, those are going to be distributed by a third party. So it's basically, again, maybe call them all vouchers with different strings attached and different distribution mechanisms. But what these do is they're going to take government money or, you know, public tax dollars, and they're going to funnel them into these accounts, vouchers, et cetera. And then students can use those to purchase, you know, any of the educational products or services that I laid out. So the impetus for doing the digital wallets is they go, well, dude, like, how are you going to, you know, the accounting, if you looked at this, there's this Heritage Foundation article that I looked at where they were promoting it. And I should note that most of the think tanks, you know, neocon, Beltway Libertarian think tanks that are supporting the rise of digital wallets for school choice, they are all linked up with what's called the State Policy Network, and that's basically a consortium of various neocon and, you know, pseudo-libertarian think tanks that are all backed by the Koch brothers. I shouldn't have took that. I shouldn't have digressed to take that detour. The accounting. Yeah, the accounting. So they go like, well, you know, you got how many parents or how many students buying, right? And each one of those is making how many different purchases? Well, they need to make sure that you're not spending it on like, and I guess some of the way that the codes are programmed, you know, they are restrictive, but like, since you can get school supplies from Walmart, I guess there's loopholes there. You could take it to Walmart. And so they're like, well, these digital wallets, right? These can be programmed and monitored by these third parties to ensure, you know, cut down on waste, fraud, and abuse, right? That's the mantra these days, right? And so you have all these different companies like Class Wallet, Odyssey, Merit International, Student First Technologies, and SAP Aruba are the most prominent ones, and they're all supported by either the Excellence in Education Foundation, which is set up by Jeb Bush, the American Enterprise Institute. Again, these are all those state policy network think tanks supported by Cato Institute. Another one's called EdChoice. That's the used to be the Milton Friedman and something for Educational Choice Heritage Foundation. Okay, but they're also backed by a bunch of venture capital firms, and you know, those connected to the PayPal mafia. So, like one in particular, Andreessen. So Odyssey. Let's look at Odyssey. Odyssey is funded by Andreessen Horowitz. Okay, and it's Mark Andreessen's.
Wait, are we talking Odyssey, like the video playing site?
No, it's not. That's Odyssey EE, right?
Yeah.
Or is it EY? Okay, yeah, this is Odyssey spelled like EY. Okay. Interesting, though, because Odyssey did have like Litecoin or something. They did kind of have a blockchain platform, but no, as far as I know, there's no. Yeah.
And might have taken money from somebody on Sand Hill Road, for all we know. I don't know. But it could fall into that category. But just to be clear, we're not talking about that Odyssey.
Yeah. No. So Andreessen and then two others, Bling Capital and Tusk Venture Partners. Now, Bling Capital is invested in Peter Thiel's Palantir, and Tusk Ventures shares common investments with Peter Thiel's Founders Fund. Okay, another one, Merit International. This one is funded, again, by Andreessen Horowitz, but it's also funded by Alumni Ventures, which, again, has common investments with Thiel's Founders Fund. So this is just a couple examples of the ways that sort of like, you know, your venture, your PayPal mafia adjacent venture capital firms in sort of the, you know, pseudo-libertarian arm of this new Republicanoid coalition are sort of dovetailing with the old school neocon beltway libertarian think tanks, right? And so you're having sort of the culture wars arm of the Republican Party and the futurist Silicon Valley arm coming together, right, to combine their public private school choice system with their fintech system as well. And some of these companies are Merit International. One of the things that it boasts, by the way, Merit International is also funded by Experian, which is one of the big three credit reporting agencies. I thought that was, you know, during lockdowns when they had the passports in Illinois, Experian was going to manage the database for the vaccine passports. Ooh. So, you know, when I see a credit reporting company looking at health records at a school, I'm like, social credit, right? I mean, you're going to permit or restrict my access to the public square based on a credit company looking at health records. Like, I don't know a better term for that than social credit, right? right. It's also funded by Stand Together Ventures Lab. Stand Together Ventures, it's the venture capital arm of this Stand Together. There's a nonprofit, there's a trust, it's another funded state policy network thing. But Merit International, that's funded by all those, it boasts that it uses a digital identity ecosystem to make sure, right, that all of that accounting, you know, the waste, fraud, and abuse, that everything moves smoothly. Now, if you take a company like Merit International, it has a digital ID system, and you look at Student First Technologies, which is using an AI platform called QuinIQ, uses human-in-the-loop machine learning, to empower stakeholders, by the way. Quote,
oh, that's of a course, quote. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So, I mean, this is your right-wing Andreessen Horowitz, PayPal, right? Well, stakeholders. So, no, your ESG stakeholder capitalism did not go away. Peter Thiel, by the way, World Economic Forum. Okay, Ken Howe, PayPal Mafia, World Economic Forum. Okay. And, you know, he's Thiel's Bilderberg as well. But and then in SAP Aruba, which partners with the parent company is a World Economic Forum partner. And then it itself partners with IBM and Amazon, two World Economic Forum partners. This one, now it's a company that kind of does a range of financial services for other companies. So it offers blockchain services, AI monitoring services, and ESG monitoring. So between Merit International, Student First Technologies, and SAP Aruba, you have three different digital wallet companies that have the three pieces you would need for an AI, blockchain, stablecoin, social credit, system hooked up to your school choice digital wallet.
Yikes. Well, you've mentioned a lot of this being sort of right-leaning, tech heavy, maybe, Heritage Foundation sort of ideas and concepts like that. What does the left think of this? What are the Randy Weingartens of the world think of this sort of new pivot with schooling? Are they on board with this, or is this going to be some political theater where they pretend to be against it, but they're actually all working for the same thing? I mean, what does the left feel about this?
Well, if we're talking about, like, you know, the mainstream left, the oligarch left, like the Randy Weingarten, and, you know, they'll probably pitch a stink about maybe this administration is emphasizing, you know, Christian nationalist, more, you know, anti-woke, anti-debt. That's probably the main area where you're going to see any kind of disagreement. But if you're talking about AI, what they're saying now, and I have friends like on the left that like are not, you know, in the left cult, so to speak, that are, mm-hmm. you know, aware of this. And we've talked about this. But as far as Weingarten goes, like, the argument they're making is, well, we have to make AI is going to take off whether or not we want it to. So we need to instill our values into it. Right. It's okay. Almost like an Elon Musk, if you can't beat it, join it type thing. So the AFT recently signed up. I don't remember. It was several hundred thousand teachers are going to go to some. They made some new institute where they're all going to get trained to use AI in the classroom. And, the companies that they're going to use is OpenAI. Google. Is it Google and Anthropic or Microsoft and Anthropic? I get them mixed up because the AI.gov website that recently got published, the archive page that they shut down, but it's still archived, said that either the API or the console app was going to have OpenAI, Anthropic, and Microsoft or Google. So one, you know, it's that middle one is I get them mixed up. But right. what they do have in common is OpenAI. You know who set up OpenAI? Elon Musk. Okay, you know who's running it now? Sam Altman. Do you know who else funded it? Peter Thiel. Okay, and so it's, you know, all those people on the right side of the spectrum are the ones that, you know, I guess Sam would be more on the left, but Bilderberg, just like Thiel. The other part is that Weingarten also announced that they're going to partner direct. AFT is going to partner directly with the World Economic Forum and set curriculum. Okay. And I also wrote, there's a whole series I wrote at Unlimited Hangout. It's four or five articles where I looked at the history of the unions, American Federation of Teachers, National Education Association, and how they are both members of a global union federation known as Education International. And you have people like Weingarten, president of AFT, but also Lily Eskelsen Garcia, who I think she was the VP of the NEI. They are board members of EI. You have other, I think the guy's name's David Edwards. He's high up at NEA. He's at EI. But then you have several others, Fred Van Leeuwen, Robert Harris, Sharon Burrow. These people are from Van Leeuwen. I think he's from the Netherlands, one of those Germanic nations. The other two are from Australia, but these people are all connected to the World Economic Forum. They have all attended several meetings there. Okay, so what I'm saying is that, you know, on the left, if unions are left, they're just as much on board with it as well. Actually, I can tell you that what's interesting. So Albert Shanker, who was the president of the AFT, I was probably a quarter century before he died and gave up the seat. He is the founding father of the charter school movement. He came up with the idea for charter schools. Okay. And Randy Weingarten has as of late pretended like she's so much against. The only problem the unions have with charter schools is they don't have unions. If they could force the charter schools to use unions, they wouldn't have any problem with them. And so on the left, yeah, there's a long history of it. And if you can go and check out that series, I wrote that because this was from Charlotte Iserbeat's files. For those that don't know what you see behind me, that about 90% of that library was hers. She also gave me all of her
papers. She had like 13 file cabinets, 34 drawers filled. And I'd stumbled onto Education International. And there's other things. Like I had, there's a, these are all in the articles. There's a document, 1960s. It's like programmed learning and programmed instruction. It's, the title is something like that. It's a showcase of B.F. Skinner's theories and methodologies for the teaching machines, ed tech, in partnership. This, in the, it was compiled in partnership with the Army, the Navy, I think the Air Force as well, and the Department of HUMRO. So it's Human Resources Research Organization, which specializes in human capital management. But this, you know, this is, again, just another example of the left – right, being on board with it as well. And then Obama. Bill Clinton was the first president to sign in the first federal charter school law. So the charter school movement started on the left. The first federal bill was pushed by the left. When Obama got in, he hired Arne Duncan to be the Secretary of Education, and charter schools took off. Exploded under that administration. You know, Duncan, and that's why he picked him, because Duncan's pedigree was he basically privatized the entire Chicago system, as I sort of alluded to earlier, and he's very friendly with Rauner as well. So this is 100% bipartisan movement. They will argue, they will pretend like they're arguing over culture war stuff to get, you know, people, regular working people, to get angry at their neighbors while they get, you know, the left foot forward and then the right foot forward. But as far as ed tech goes, they are all on board with it.
Are they on board with it globally? You mentioned some of the World Economic Forum getting involved with writing in education and inside America. I'm assuming that it's not limited to America. Is this slated for Western Europe or the West in general?
Yeah, well, that's where the book kind of, you know, it's the technocratic globalization of corporatized education. Because one of the things that Charlotte pointed out and I kind of built on was that, well, if the charter school movement, or the, we'll say school of choice, so charter schools and voucher programs, if this new system is fully successful, she says, you won't have an elected school board anymore. You won't have a civil process of education anymore. I mean, you'll have government education, but as far as, you know, local people having any say as a local community and voicing your opinion, that's going to be gone. Because, you know, the charter schools, they don't have school boards. They're companies. They have boards. You know, take your money somewhere else if you don't like it. That's how they see it. So... So we kind of looked at it like, well, if that system takes over, and she was like, you know, she looked at it like one domino, like if you can get rid of the, you know, civil process at the locally elected school board, it's right. What happens to all the other institutions that we actually have some sort of public oversight? Right. But we were kind of looking at it like, so the charter school movement, cause you also have, virtual online charter schools, which are global. Now, Pearson, I mentioned, they have one. It's called Connections Academy. I've written extensively about it. The first and biggest was K-12 Inc. Now, K-12 Inc. was created by Bill Bennett. He was the Secretary of Education under Reagan, following T.H. Bell. T.H. Bell was the Secretary of Education that Charlotte worked under. So Bill Bennett, you know, was basically a direct adherent or of the Project Best legacy, right? He kind of carried that on. So, you know, we were looking at it like, well, you know, you could have global, you could have a Pearson Connections Academy or a K-12 International that could, you know, not just basically service everybody in the United States, but could serve people all over the world as well. Now, that's part of it. But then what I realized when I started looking at this new fintech system is makes it even easier to achieve. Because now, if you take the money, you know, people like Corey DeAngelis, he's the sort of the mascot for school of choice now. He's like, fund students, not buildings. You know, it sounds great, except that the difference is if you take that money and you go to the building and the money comes with government strings, okay, and you don't like what the government, you know, don't like the woke, you don't want to get your jab, etc., you move out of the building where the government money and the strings are not attached. But if you attach the money to the student, It doesn't matter where the student goes. The government strings are attached to that student, whether they go to a public school, a private school, a charter school, whether they go to a religious school, whether they do homeschooling, whether it's an online charter school. Okay. And what that means is that student, they're all of the oversight of their learning is going to be based on whoever they buy products from. They take the money out of the ESA, they go to Pearson here, they go to Dreambox there, they go to Clever or Newton or, right, Course Here, whatever platform they want to use. And so now, you know, it's not just you got to deal with a corporate charter school industry. You've got like eight other service providers that have their own contract. There's no room for a school board involved in that. But when you plug in the stablecoin factor to it, one of the things that, you know, Mark Goodwin helped me understand was sort of the global implications of this genius act and how this is going to basically make it easier for people outside the U.S. to get access to not just U.S. banks, but U.S. dollars, right? And can trade. Well, if you can get U.S. bank and a U.S. dollar, why can't you have you can go take that stablecoin and sign up for, I mean, you might not get a voucher money, but you can still purchase, you can spend that money on Alpha School or Out School. Now they've got these virtual online charter schools, no human beings, 100% AI. So now so this is, you know, now you know what I says, you know what? I see why they called it the Genius Act now, because it's going to, like, you know, it's going to give them at least another decades of dollar hegemony. It's going to incentivize companies to put money into it. It's going to even individuals at the ground level. Right. And then that's also going to expand access to American companies. And it's going to also expand access to this AI system. And so, yes, long term, I see all of this sort of congealing into a singular global technocracy.
Sounds like you're not trusting the plan hard enough.
I don't trust very many plans. I don't trust my own plans most of the time.
Well, let's wrap up with this. I want to make sure everybody knows where to find you, where to support your book. School World Order is available. Get the book. I've got a copy. I've got a physical copy. You were nice enough to mail it to me. Unlimitedhangout.com is obviously a great place for articles just in general, but your articles are there as well. And we love Whitney. Whitney's been, we've been friends over the years, and it's a great resource. Where else? Where else can people find you? Where can they support your work? Where can they find out what you're working on next?
schoolworldorder.info is my website. It has a link to all the social media, a link to Trying Day where you can get the book. I just updated it. I'm not super fast, you know, it takes me a while to update. So if you're wondering, you go to the website and you're like, hey, is this all the way updated? The places where you'd find something that's not there would be on my X account, and that's Taoist Professor, at Taoist Professor or Professor Taoist or something like that. It's one way or the other. If you put in Taoist Professor, it'll show up. I'm the only one that has either of those words in any combination on Twitter. And then you can also go to Unlimited Hangout, and that will have my most recent article as well. If you can support me, I do have a subscriber database, so it's up to 5,500 interconnected nodes, 300 something files, and I forget how many links, but that's got rare documents from Charlotte's archives and sort of maps out everything I've ever written is mapped into that brain database. So since the upswing is taking my hours, if you can, subscribe, it'll help a little bit. And so, yeah, that's where you can find everything.
That's John Klesak, everyone. Go to unlimitedhangout.com, support his work, find out, put him on your radar, follow him on X, do it, all those things. If you want to find me, I'm easy to find, macroaggressions.io. Just one-stop shop for all that. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you again soon.